I'm Christopher Lydon, continuing a conversation with the author James Douglas about the assassination of President John F. Kennedy 50 years ago this fall. We're talking about a murder mystery that still resonates in the politics and the mythology of our country. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. James Douglas's book is titled JFK and the Unspeakable. It's a conspiracy book with a scholar's footnotes and a theological subtext. It tells, by any measure, a shocking and outrageous story of a plot inside the national security apparatus and the Central Intelligence Agency to kill the president and stop his turn toward peace, toward ending the Cold War with the Soviet Union and exiting the war in Vietnam. The story is appalling, but not entirely unfamiliar. The Douglas version draws on a vast trove of public evidence and research into the case. Douglas himself is a sometime college professor and a Catholic worker peace activist in Birmingham, Alabama. He's drawing not least on the theological speculations of a JFK contemporary, the late Trappist monk and author Thomas Merton, who foresaw a miracle that would inspire a change in Kennedy's direction and mark him at the same time for death. In this second half of our long conversation over Skype, Jim Douglas is telling me further about suspicions inside the Kennedy circle and the encouragement he's taken, for example, from the JFK speechwriter and counselor Ted Sorensen. Also this year from JFK's nephew, Robert Kennedy Jr. As we pick up the thread here, Jim Douglas notes that he's also building on the momentum of Oliver Stone's still disputed version in the 1991 movie JFK of a military coup against the president. I asked Jim Douglas if it's fair to think of his book as Oliver Stone with footnotes.
No, it's not fair, because Oliver Stone made the book possible, but it has a lot more information than was available to Oliver Stone. So what Oliver Stone did by his film was to push for people who saw the film to push their representatives in the government, members of the House of Representatives and the Senate and so forth, to pass a law to make public information regarding JFK's assassination. The law was passed. We hardly know that it was passed because our media doesn't tell us about these things. And as a result of that, there are literally millions of documents. I usually say hundreds of thousands, but it goes into millions of documents that have been declassified. And I couldn't have written JFK and the Unspeakable if Oliver Stone had not done his film and pushed for that law.
You've extended Oliver Stone, but he introduced the basic theory in a movie that millions and millions of people saw, that Kennedy had been killed by his own national security state. I mention it just because yours is still a contrary and unconventional view, but it's not unfamiliar, and you're not alone.
That is true. And there are other people besides Oliver who have written in this area. And I mentioned one book by a man named David Talbot, and people who don't write on the assassination per se, some of whom you were citing, they present the same story, but only half of it. And I think you need the full story in order to understand the assassination.
I said to Jeffrey Sachs in a conversation about his book about JFK that you and he have the same basic moral arc of the narrative, except he leaves out the unspeakable and he does not want to connect Kennedy's peacemaking with his death. I don't quite know why he stops short of that result, but he does.
Well, it is unspeakable. That's why almost everybody stops short. It's unspeakable.
Let's come to the assassination. On what seems a critical question, which is who gave the orders to assassinate President Kennedy, you write that there is no hard or conclusive evidence. But you say it is obvious that it was carried out by the CIA. I mean, I want to say not so fast. You write the CIA's fingerprints are all over the crime and the events leading up to it. Summarize the best evidence as you've compiled it.
The best evidence as I've compiled it is, number one, I'll give you 20 specific pieces of evidence.
Give us three, maybe five.
Number one, Lee Harvey Oswald, Marine Corps radar operator 57 to 58 at Atsugi Air Force Base. He's monitoring the CIA's top secret U-2 spy plane flights over the Soviet Union and China. This is the background of the man who is the person identified as a lone assassin. Well, he's working with the CIA from 57, 58 onwards. Number two, in 59 to 62, ex-Marine Oswald is a so-called defector to the Soviet Union. He's saying, however, that he's turning over classified radar information to the Russians. This is all public information. He says that to the Russians, and he says it even to the U.S. representatives at the embassy in Moscow, our embassy. And then when he comes back from the Soviet Union, he's given U.S. State Department funding to return to the country he'd betrayed. What is going on here? Number three, then you've got President Kennedy in the spring of 61 saying he'd been lied to and manipulated by CIA officials, wants to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. So on the one side, you got Oswald, who's working with the CIA and who's a false defector to the Soviet Union. And you've got Kennedy saying he wants to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. And then the fourth piece of evidence, Oswald, when he returns to the U.S., he's welcomed back and befriended by CIA asset George de Morenshield, who becomes his mentor at the instigation of Dallas CIA domestic contact service chief J. Walton Moore. This is all public information I'm giving you. At the end of October 62, then that's when Kennedy and Khrushchev, by mutual concessions, resolved the Cuban Missile Crisis. And at the same time as that's happening, Oswald has obtained a job. This is a so-called defector to the Soviet Union. He's obtained a job working on maps that are top secret maps in Dallas, Texas. How did he get such kind of a job except by government intervention?
That's an impressive start, and you haven't even mentioned so many other fascinating leads. I was struck also by Dr. Crenshaw, who saw the clean entry wound in Kennedy's throat and the blown away back of his head, which suggested shooters in front of him. Also, the death of Bill Pitzer, the photographer, of the autopsy at Bethesda Naval Hospital. I mean, there's so many pieces here. Explain the gaps, and everybody agrees they're there, in the Warren Commission.
Well, the Warren Commission, if you read the 24 or so backup volumes to the Warren Report, you find all kinds of things that are conflicting with the report itself. Some of the things that I've been telling you about Oswald are actually in the backup volumes and in the research for the Warren Commission report. But then when you begin to investigate even more deeply by going into the witnesses who are called before the Warren Commission, you then realize that the witnesses are being manipulated and are being misquoted. So there are all these levels of evidence, and what you get in the Warren report is basically zilch in terms of what the witnesses began telling in their initial meetings or their efforts to come to the Warren Commission. And a number of those witnesses are being threatened.
How do we explain this suppression? I think so many people, including me, are just at a loss in what feels like a conspiracy of silence around this subject, a conspiracy to avoid it, even on the 50th anniversary.
That's what Charles Crenshaw, the doctor, called it, a conspiracy of silence. He saw the men in suits, as he put them, around the operating room in Parkland Hospital, who even their presence gave a very threatening air to his efforts to save President Kennedy's life. I think anybody who's in a position of power today, even 50 years removed from the event, does not want to go to anything that is seriously exploring the truth of John F. Kennedy's assassination.
I've always wondered why Robert Kennedy, who knew everything about his brother, didn't get to the bottom of this.
He was moving toward the bottom of it. That's why he was killed. Robert Kennedy said to his friends that he had to become president of the United States to have the power to reconvene the Warren Commission and get to the bottom of his brother's assassination. He said that. He said that to friends. And of course, that was not a process that was going to be effective. He wasn't going to be allowed to become president of the United States. 15 minutes after he turned the corner toward winning the presidency in California, he was killed. If he had lost California, he might have lived. But Robert Kennedy, from day one, when John F. Kennedy was killed, he was on the heels of the CIA. He was asking John McCone that afternoon, John McCone being the head of the CIA, if the agency had killed his brother. And John McCone, if they had killed his brother, he wouldn't even have known it, because even though he was head of the agency, he'd been appointed by John F. Kennedy, he would have been out of the loop.
But I always supposed that Robert Kennedy didn't want the world to know other pieces of this story, including the women involved, including the mafia involved, including their own efforts to assassinate Castro. Was not Robert Kennedy turned off by the dark side of their own story?
I think Robert Kennedy was turned off by any dark side. He was a person who, perhaps more than his brother, was focused on a liberation of all of us from the dark side. And John F. Kennedy had weaknesses that Robert F. Kennedy did not have, and vice versa. I don't think that John F. Kennedy's dark side went to killing Fidel Castro. I think that's a false story that's been put out in order to distract from his peacemaking. And I think a lot of the dark side that's been presented of John F. Kennedy is far darker than the reality. So I think a lot of that is in order to keep us from focusing on why he was killed. And the reason why he was killed was his peacemaking and his efforts to move us as a country in the direction of not only survival, but of actually a world in which we would want to survive.
Why wouldn't Robert Kennedy have wanted to say exactly that?
He did say that. He said it many times.
He didn't say Kennedy was destroyed by his own security people because they didn't want him to make peace.
He didn't say that, because to say that, he needed evidence to back it up. I don't just say that either. I had 12 years of research based on a lot of materials that Robert Kennedy didn't have in his possession, even as Attorney General of the United States. He couldn't get into the inside of the CIA as Attorney General, couldn't get into the inside of even his own department, which included, of course, the FBI. Hoover and the FBI, they would withhold everything from Robert Kennedy, especially after the assassination of his brother. Robert Kennedy had really no power because Hoover was reporting directly, the head of the FBI was reporting directly to the new president, Johnson. And Robert Kennedy was totally out of the loop. He had no power then. As soon as John F. Kennedy lost power, so did Robert Kennedy. And so Robert Kennedy was focusing on achieving the presidency, first by the step of going through the Senate in New York, and finally by running as president. So that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to get to the place where he could have the evidence to back up his suspicions.
Did Lyndon Johnson know how he came to power? Did he want to know?
I think Lyndon Johnson had an awareness of what was going to happen in Dallas. I do not think he was a major plotter of it. Lyndon Johnson certainly was heavily involved in the cover-up of the assassination. He appointed Alan Dulles the primary suspect by any real assessment of conspiring to kill the president. Lyndon Johnson appointed him to the Warren Commission. It actually was more the Dulles Commission than the Warren Commission. And that's the man whom Kennedy had fired for conspiring against him at the Bay of Pigs. So you've got the fox investigating the murder in the hen house. That's no investigation. That's simply a cover-up. Johnson's involved in all of that.
Do you think the Kennedy family really wants to know and wants us to know the real story in JFK's death?
Yes, emphatically. Emphatically, yes.
Who, for example?
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He emphatically wants to know the truth of his uncle's assassination, the truth of his uncle's murder. He said in January of this year in an interview with Charlie Rose in Dallas that he knew that his father, the attorney general whom we were just talking about, he knew that his father didn't agree with the Warren Commission. Robert Kennedy has just this year confirmed publicly what we knew from researchers like myself, that his father disbelieved that information from the beginning. So Robert Kennedy is an example of a member of the family who wants to know the truth and is actively seeking it.
What would it take 50 years later, when so many people are dead, to nail a conviction in this case?
What would it take to nail a conviction? Would take a revolution. Would take a revolution in which we became a genuine democracy rather than a national security state, in which we had all of this information not only declassified, as much of it is already, but available in a courtroom context where our government truly recognized international law. We're not in any state now where this kind of evidence is going to be given a genuine hearing in a U.S. court.
Jim Douglas, you've said that 75% of the American people do not believe the lone assassin story, and yet it remains the official and the media account of what happened. How do we get ourselves out of this paradox? I mean, it could drive us crazy.
Well, it already has driven us crazy. The kind of policy decisions that are made in a matter of course by the current administration and every administration since Kennedy's presidency have been crazy. A national security state threatening the entire world with destruction by nuclear weapons, as has been the case in all of those years, is literally crazy. So we are already crazy. So how do we get out of this? Through a nonviolent revolution. And that is through people like Edward Snowden, through people like Bradley Chelsea Manning, through people like Daniel Ellsberg before them, through people like you, asking genuine questions in a context where people can hear those questions and can hear somebody trying to genuinely answer them.
Well, I just ask questions, and I think most people basically share my sort of fundamental curiosity. It is puzzling that so much of this commemoration of the 50th anniversary of President Kennedy's death still turns either on one of two things: the scandal of his sex life or his miserable health or his feel-good drugs or various other things, or the glamour and that still dazzling beauty and charm that can be spun around the story. And yet we're missing sort of the main question, I think.
I don't know that that's puzzling. I think that's evasion. And it's not wanting to go there by people who hold positions of power. I think it's part of what a man named Frank Wisner in the 1950s as head of the propaganda in the Central Intelligence Agency called the Mighty Wurlitzer. And the Mighty Wurlitzer is a great big instrument of lies. And it tells lies about Kennedy because they are, quote, necessary from the standpoint of the same national security state extended into the present to maintain policies that are in support of that very small number of people who have a huge amount of wealth as a part of the military-industrial complex and as a part of just plain profiteering companies. That's the pyramid of power, and that's the Mighty Wurlitzer working on its behalf, and that's why the truth of John F. Kennedy's assassination is not so available through those media.
James Douglas, circle back to the beginning. I want to know more about you, how you got onto this story, how you do it, but I also want you to spell out your attachment to Thomas Merton, the theologian, very popular and important writer in the middle of the 20th century, and his notion, and yours now, of the unspeakable. But start with you. Who is James Douglas?
I'm a Catholic worker. That means my wife Shelley and I have a house of hospitality for homeless families in Birmingham, Alabama, where we live. It means that we are peace and justice activists in the footsteps of the founder of the Catholic movement, co-founder, Dorothy Day. It means that I've been to jail for a year and a half for acts of nonviolent civil disobedience against the Vietnam War, nuclear weapons. That's my life. I was a professor, taught at Notre Dame in the Peace Studies program, taught at Bellarmine College, now University in Louisville, Kentucky. And that's how I met Thomas Merton, because I taught in 1965 at Bellarmine College near the Abbey of Gethsemane, where the monk Thomas Merton lived and wrote. And I used to go down and visit with him. And I'd corresponded with him for years before that. And we were friends. And I've learned a lot more from him since he died, because I've studied his work.
Thomas Merton seemed to suggest, as he observed John Kennedy, that he was marked for assassination, perhaps, but also courting a miracle for peace. Kennedy's own turning could be construed as a miracle, but it did end in assassination. I mean, what weight should we give the speculations of this Trappist monk from afar, prophetic, but also very detached?
Well, Thomas Merton didn't ascribe to himself any inside knowledge of what was going on in Washington. Nevertheless, when one reads this monk who didn't watch television, who didn't read newspapers, but who was in correspondence with people who had very insightful views and shared them with Merton, I learned that Merton understood U.S. first strike policy from his monastery better than the Beltway commentators did. He saw that the U.S. was on the edge of a total nuclear war and even trying to initiate it to win it. And that's astounding for him to have seen all of that from his monastery. But it corresponds to inside government documents that we now have available. We can read the records, and they correspond more to Merton's analysis than they do to the political commentators. He had an incredible bunch of antennae on his head and in his heart from the things that he learned from friends who were involved in all kinds of pursuits in the outside world. I think Thomas Merton was a genius of the spirit. His analysis of Kennedy in a letter he wrote in a fairly early period of Kennedy's presidency, the first year or so, he said, "I have little confidence in Kennedy." And he goes on to say why he doesn't have confidence in him, that he lacks the kind of creative imagination, deeper kind of sensitivity that's needed. And he says he's too much the time and life mentality, referring to Henry Luce's publications. And he says Kennedy seems to be have a kind of consciousness that's nothing further, Merton thinks, in reality, from, say, Lincoln. So he's very negative about Kennedy in this first year. And then that's when he begins to get into his prophetic vision of Kennedy. He says, what's really needed for a man who's in a position like that is really not shrewdness or craft, but what the politicians don't have: depth, humanity, and a certain totality of self-forgetfulness and compassion, not just for individuals, but for humanity as a whole, a deeper kind of dedication. Maybe, Merton says, Kennedy will break through into that someday by miracle, but such people are before long marked out for assassination. So what he's saying is that for Kennedy to be the president we need, he's going to have to break through his sort of superficial consciousness into a deeper kind of humanity by miracle. And that if he does so, that's when he's going to be marked out for assassination. That's a contingent prophecy. If Kennedy goes that way, he's going to go the way of Dallas. And that's, in fact, what's happened through his presidency. He does break through, and he does wind up in Dallas.
What he suggests and what you underline is that Kennedy also brought courage to these questions, courage that we barely associate with politics anymore at all.
I cannot imagine the pressures on that man. He was alone, except for his brother and a few people like Ted Sorensen. He was alone in the decisions he took toward peace, except for his enemy, Nikita Khrushchev, who said, "Oh, Mr. Kennedy, I hope you win. We're going to have 6 years together, working together for peace." This is what Khrushchev says in his correspondence, his secret correspondence with Kennedy, which we haven't even talked about that. That's another element in his assassination. He's secretly corresponding and saying things with Nikita Khrushchev in peacemaking efforts that he doesn't want people to see publicly. There are all kinds of things that Kennedy is doing, extraordinary steps that take him into that deeper level of humanity that Merton says he really has to go in order to be the president we need at a time where we're on the edge of total nuclear war. Kennedy goes there, and because he goes there, he is, just as Merton says, marked out for assassination. Merton says that skeptically of him and knows what the consequences will be if his skepticism is overcome. It is.
So come back to this matter of the unspeakable. What is this satanic, almost impossible to grasp force, this systematic evil that goes beyond the imagination, as you write it? What does that tell us? It sounds like an old-fashioned notion of the devil or Satan or evil itself.
Well, the way Merton describes it is a way that we can understand in ourselves. He describes it as a void. This is in his great book, Raids on the Unspeakable, which is what I'm drawing from to understand the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Merton says that the unspeakable is at bottom a void. It is the void, he says, that contradicts everything that is spoken even before the words are said. The void that gets into the language of public and official declarations at the very moment when they are pronounced and makes them ring dead with the hollowness of the abyss. That's what makes possible the assassination of a president. That's what makes possible the kind of surveillance of American citizens today that is in total violation of the U.S. Constitution and of our rights to privacy. It's what makes possible the kind of wars that have been waged by one president after the other since John F. Kennedy. So this void of responsibility, this void of compassion, this void of connection with other people, this void of especially responsibility, that is, being responsible for decisions that we make in our professions, which are decisions that contribute to all of this war making, unless we can be responsible for them, we are part of the unspeakable. And the reason that it's an unspeakable reality is we don't have the freedom, unless we choose to be free, to say what is the truth of what we do and of what contributes to this entire process. So the unspeakable is the void in ourselves. If we don't speak the truth, we don't live it out.
James Douglas, we have spoken of the unspeakable, and it's not quite conclusive, but it's deeply interesting. And I have to say, it's so much more satisfying and more interesting than the endless recapitulations of JFK's haircuts or his sailing or his charm or even his wit. I think we're coming closer to the man, and maybe we're coming closer, in fact, to the story of his death. I admire your book, and I admire you, and I surely enjoy this conversation.
Thank you so much, Chris. I've enjoyed it, and I think we've taken a step toward knowing the truth more deeply, and hopefully other people can take that step with us.
James Douglas's book is JFK and the Unspeakable. Mary McGrath produced and edited our conversation. We'll have several more reflections this fall on the speakable as well as unspeakable dimensions of the Kennedy legacy. And in all of them, we'll count on listeners, that's you, to share your Kennedy wisdom, your theories, your lessons at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lighton. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Project.